Dr. Cheryl Selman, and welcome to What Women Must Know. Thank you for joining me today, because I have another really important and profound conversation that I will be sharing with you. And as always, this program is dedicated to empowering you with truthful information so you can make the most informed decisions possible regarding your health and well-being. And as always, it's a time to just really delve more deeply into many topics, but today we're going to be talking about a topic that is extremely relevant for you to know about. Before I go there, I want to remind you to please go to my website, whatwomenmustknow.com, and to my Facebook page, which is also What Women Must Know, because I send out regular articles, I post on a daily basis, ongoing information, and even these radio shows get sent out to you either through my Facebook page or through my e-list on my website. So it's a way to just make sure you keep listening and don't miss one episode of the show. It's always so enlightening. And I know I learn a lot, and I know you will also be learning heaps as well. So what are we discussing today? We're talking about a new book that has recently been released called The Cheese Trap: How Breaking a Surprising Addiction Will Help You Lose Weight, Gain Energy, and Get Healthy, by Dr. Neil Barnard. And I just want to share a little bit about Dr. Barnard. He is the president and founder of the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, a nonprofit organization based in Washington, D.C. His research has been published in Scientific American, the American Journal of Cardiology, and other major journals. Dr. Barnard is the author of 6 previous books, including Foods That Fight Pain and Food for Life. He is a frequent lecturer appearing across the country and an adjunct professor of medicine at the George Washington University School of Medicine, and he lives in Washington, D.C. So it's a great pleasure to have Dr. Neil Barnard with us on the show. So welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be with you today.
Well, it's great having you, and as always, you're provocative. And, you know, you are bringing to light information that we either don't really have full access to, or maybe just hear bits of it, or maybe we're just operating out of a lot of myths and misinformation. So it's great having you share this topic, and we're going to be talking about cheese. Now, cheese is a very delicate issue for people because it's everywhere, and you have some fascinating statistics about our consumption of cheese, and particularly we're going to be exploring how it is affecting our weight, which we know is of epidemic proportions, the whole condition of our fat that's happening to our bodies, and lots of other things as well. So why don't we just start by looking at some of the statistics that you bring to light in your book?
Sure. I have to say it's been a quirky subject for us, too. 10 years ago, I was doing an NIH-funded research study where we were trying to figure out what is the best diet for diabetes, and we found that a totally plant-based diet where there's no meat, no dairy at all worked the best. People lost the most weight, and they felt the best, and their energy was the best, and their cholesterols and blood sugars were the best, and the patients actually quite liked it because they could eat spaghetti and things which they hadn't been able to eat on their diabetic diet. However, people were craving cheese. And specifically cheese, not ice cream, not yogurt. It was, they had this thing for cheese, and so we started to look into it. And then parallel with that, you have noticed, as we have noticed, a couple of things where we're trying to figure out what it's all about. And number one is weight. Why are Americans continuing to gain weight? 2/3 of Americans are overweight, even though sugar consumption has been dropping now for almost 20 years. Sugar consumption has been falling quite significantly, but people are getting heavier. The second thing is we're seeing more hormonal issues, fertility problems. And these questions started to come together with some disturbing numbers. First of all, the average American, it turns out, consumes more than 60,000 calories worth of cheese every year. If you add up the feta on their salad and the cheese on the pizza or in a grilled cheese sandwich, it's more than 60,000 calories that you don't need at all. The second thing is cheese has estradiol in it. I'm talking about the female sex hormone because mm-hmm. the cows are pregnant. So we started to look at these things and trying to see if this could explain some of these things that we have been noticing, and I think that they might. And, of course, that gives us conflict because everyone thinks mac and cheese is great, and this is a wonderful part of our culture and so forth. Could it really be the reasons why we're heavy and having hormone-related problems? So that's where we are.
Well, so you have a statistic that also says it talks about how much cheese we used to eat, and
right.
you know, and then how much the average American is eating in the present day. Can you share that statistic with
yes.
us?
Yes. This comes from the USDA. In 1909, they first started figuring out what Americans were eating. Americans ate 3.8 pounds of cheese, in other words, less than 4 pounds, in a whole year on average in 1909. But fast food chains came in, and then pizza places came in the 70s, 80s, 90s. And as of about 2013, it had gone up from 3.8 pounds to 33 pounds. And now in 2017, it's 35 pounds of cheese. That's the amount the average person consumes. And I don't eat any, so someone else is getting 70 pounds, I guess.
So. Well, okay, so let me ask you, when we're talking about cheese, are we talking about dairy as a whole, or are we talking specifically about cheese in your research?
That's really an important point. We're talking about dairy, first of all, because some of the things I describe in the cheese trap have to do with dairy proteins. If your joints are sore or if you're getting migraine headaches, that's probably the protein in cheese. And the dairy fat is a problem, the saturated fat. These things are in most all dairy products. They're in milk. The reason we're keying in on cheese is everything gets concentrated in the cheese. There's much more of that sensitizing protein. There is more cholesterol, more sodium, more fat by far, and probably more hormones as well. Whatever's in the milk is concentrated in the cheese.
So I was told that the gluten molecule, so we all know right now that gluten is an issue for many people. So many of us are going gluten-free, me included, because we just can't digest the gluten that is present in the foods that contain gluten, you know, wheat being the primary one, but not the only one. And so I was told that gluten molecule, the lactose molecule is very similar to the gluten molecule. So is there truth to that?
Not exactly. I think where we're going with this is that lactose is the milk sugar, and that's in a baby calf or a baby human or any baby mammal, they have enzymes that can break it apart. And then as you leave the age of weaning behind, those enzymes start to go away, and so you can no longer digest it, and you drink milk and you get diarrhea and bloating because you can't digest the sugar anymore, and bacteria do ferment it, and then you get gassy. Many people carry a genetic mutation, most white people carry a genetic mutation that causes those enzymes to persist longer in life, so they digest the milk sugar, whereas almost everybody else tends to lose that sooner or later, in later childhood or early adulthood. I think the thing that's more like gluten is some people have talked about opiates, whether there could be an opiate effect of gluten, meaning that's why we love bread so much. I don't know if that's true or not, but what we have found is there's clearly an opiate in cheese. It's derived not from the lactose sugar, but it's derived from the protein that cow's milk has coated into its protein, tiny molecules that have opiate activity. What I mean by that is they attach to the brain at the very same receptor sites that heroin or morphine attach to, and they cause an opiate effect. I don't mean to say that milk proteins have an effect as strong as morphine. The strongest ones have about one-tenth the binding power of pure morphine. So what we believe nature was trying to do was to calm down the baby. So the nursing baby gets this protein and sugar and hormones and everything else, and a little bit of a calming effect from the opiates. And then if you decide as an adult you're going to drink milk or concentrate it into cheese, you get more of the opiate, which is probably one of the reasons why people love cheese so much and why people hearing this interview are saying, don't take my cheese away, I really need it. You obviously don't need it, but we're hooked on it, almost like a drug for some people.
Well, so there is this molecule called casomorphins that you talk
that's
about
right.
in your book. So that's what we're talking about. So there is, when we eat cheese, it can actually stimulate a response that calms us down. Is that what the research is showing?
Let me differentiate what we know from what we think. What we know is that when these proteins are digested in your digestive tract, they do release these opiates. And we also have found from quite an interesting detective story of research that they do pass into the blood and then they pass into the brain. There was some question about that. People thought, no, the blood-brain barrier would keep them out. It appears that they do pass through quite easily. And so that's what we know. And we know that they attach to the very same receptors as heroin, that they do have opiate activity. What we are guessing is that this isn't just a fluke of nature. We're guessing that this evolved as a mechanism that might underlie the mother-infant bond, that the breastfeeding baby gets a little bit of feel-good from mom. But nature never figured that this would persist in adulthood because nature didn't think that cow's milk would be consumed by anybody in adulthood, certainly not a great ape like a human being.
So initially there was some benefit for that, but what you're saying is that we are now consuming cheeses in excess. We might even say never before in the history of humanity have we as a whole been consuming so much cheese in so many forms. And there are other components of cheese that add to the problem, not just the addictive tendency that is there for some of us through
that's
those
right.
casomorphines. So
that's right. You know, if you can be addicted to something and it's not harmful, like your morning cup of coffee, caffeine is clearly addictive. There's no question about it. But you'd have to say, who cares? Is it really hurting me? And by the same token, there are things that are fattening, but aren't addictive. I mean, lard is clearly fattening, but people don't really like it that much, so they don't get hooked on it. Cheese is one of those things that's both addicting, if I can use that word, or habit-forming or whatever word you want, and it's also pretty fattening. So it's got the worst of both worlds, I think.
So let's talk about how cheese contributes to gaining weight, and which kind of ties in also with the estradiol connection
yes.
with cheese. So help us understand more about that aspect.
Yeah, there are a number of issues to be concerned about. If you want to fatten up livestock on your cattle farm, for example, they're given sex hormones, a variety of them. But you don't have to go to a cattle farm to get it. If you are consuming milk, you get little traces of estradiol, and if you are eating cheese, it's concentrated in the cheese. Here's where this comes from. A cow doesn't give any milk until she has been impregnated and then gives birth. And the farmers the cows are artificially inseminated every single year, up until about age four, at which point they're killed and replaced with their unfortunate progeny who have to go through the same thing again. But a dairy cow is pregnant 9 months out of every year, and as the pregnancy comes toward term, she is producing quite a lot of estrogen, specifically estradiol, which is pretty much a match for human estradiol, and it gets into the milk. And there's a little bit of it in milk, but when you turn milk into cheese, the fat is concentrated, and that's where the estradiol goes. So I am quite prepared to believe that the amounts of estrogen in dairy products are pretty small. But where we've become concerned is when you compare blood levels of estradiol in a woman who drinks milk versus a woman who doesn't. Australian researchers found that it was quite a measurable difference. In other words, it did seem to have an effect. Researchers in Rochester, New York, went into a male fertility clinic and found that the men consuming the most cheese had the biggest fertility problems. Specifically, their sperm counts were low. And so this raises now the question. Let's say my six-year-old boy loves cheese, and so we're going to pile it on, and I'm unaware of it, but I'm feeding him estradiol, and he's going to consume maybe 15, 20, 25 pounds of this every single year. Or my daughter, if I feed her the same, and could I be increasing the risk of hormone issues in these kids or in an adult? And I think the answer is quite possibly yes. But it gets worse. As kids gain weight from eating this very fatty substance, their bodies start making more hormones on their own. And it all starts with this cultural aberration of thinking that we need the milk from a cow and all these products that come from it, when in reality that has nothing to do with nature. It has only to do with sort of a cultural wrong turn.
What about pesticides being accumulating in the fat in cheese? Is that a problem?
Yeah, oh, wow. Interesting point. People think of pesticides in fish, of course, because, you know, fish live in the human sewer and so forth, and metals and things will get into them, and that's all true. And you have warnings for pregnant women, don't consume this fish and that fish and the other fish. And we tend to not think about it with cow's milk products, but cows are bio-concentrating animals. In other words, they may eat some pesticides on the feed grains that they're eating. They're also eating GMO food all day long, of course. A person who would not consume GMO food themselves, well, the cows are eating that all day. Anyway, things that the cow eats tend to be concentrated in the milk. And that can be pesticides and other industrial chemicals and so forth. And the same is true with human milk. A woman who breastfeeds gives quite a large load of her accumulated chemical consumption to her firstborn child through breast milk. Now, don't get me wrong. There is nothing like breastfeeding. Breastfeeding should be, in my view, it's a part of reproduction. And bottle feeding is not the same. But we do have to recognize that there's a real advantage to a person keeping their own body as clean as possible. And if you're consuming stuff that came from a cow's body and got concentrated in the cow's milk, clean is not a word that would apply to it.
So if people see organic cheese or cheese from grass-fed cows, it doesn't really apply in the context of your research because it's still concentrated fats.
Sure.
And
cheese, well, absolutely. If you're getting organic cheese, you could joke that you're getting organic estradiol.
Right.
The hormones are still there. Even the organic ones that the farmers pretend that these animals want to get artificially inseminated, treated this way, they are all impregnated, no matter where they're from, and they're all producing hormones all the time. But that's really just the tip of the iceberg. It gets much worse. To produce cheese, you concentrate the fat. So the typical cheese is 70% fat, and the calorie content of it ends up being more than 60,000 calories a year, 35 pounds of this stuff. So it's a massive contributor of unnecessary calories. And then to flavor it up and to slow down the bacterial action, the dairy adds salt to it. And there is, ounce per ounce, there is much more salt in cheese than there is in potato chips or pretzels or something like that. It's a very salty food. And so we think blood pressure, but also think water weight. If you're feeling overweight, having trouble losing weight, you're feeling blobby and bloated, could it be that the fat in cheese is adding to body fat and that the salt is making you have trouble with water weight? So we're suddenly starting to explain the things that people experience, but they never, ever connected it with all the cheese they're eating.
Right. So what about cheeses like goat's cheese? I mean, I was always told that goat's milk is more digestible and less fatty, and especially feta is not a hard saturated fat as much as the cow's milk. What are your thoughts about that?
I think that the reason that people choose those sometimes is it's not from a health standpoint. It's really the idea that it sounds more romantic. Feta, we think of Greek islands, or a goat cheese, you think maybe it's some little small local operation that must be better. If you look at the proportion of it that's bad fat, saturated fat, it's a little bit higher for those than it is for cow's milk. And that's why they're a little more buttery and why people tend to prefer them. They can be either more watery or less watery depending on how it is manufactured, but the proportion of the fat that is the bad fat, saturated fat, is higher in the goat cheese than it is in the cow's milk.
Wow.
And I'm sure I'm cheering up all of the people listening to this.
Well, let me ask you this question. From your research and what you've written about in your book, are you advising people to reduce the amount of cheese? Or are you saying it's best to cut it out entirely, find other alternatives? What is it that you are wanting people to hear from your message?
My message, first of all, people can do whatever they wish to with this information. However, it's important to remember a couple of things. When people are hooked on something, the first response is always to say, well, I'm not going to cut it out, but I'm just going to have less. And what we've learned is a couple of things. We learned that smokers who cut down still get lung cancer, and also they never get free of it. They keep focusing on it. When a person has an issue with a food, and they know they got an issue with the food, if they cut down, they still have whatever problems that food causes. Let's say it's migraine from the protein or sore joints or inflammation. They're still going to have those problems, even if they're eating half the amount or three-quarters of the amount. The second thing is they never give themselves the opportunity to be free of it. If you have not had – take chocolate as a different example. If you haven't had chocolate in a month, you crave it less than if you had it yesterday. And if a person is having trouble with their weight or they've got diabetes or something, they very often find it much easier to just forget about it and set it aside and stop buying it and give themselves a break. But because that sounds draconian, to do it just for a short time, like 3 weeks, and see how they feel. And usually two things will have happened. They'll be losing weight, and they're physically healthier, but the other thing is their tastes are starting to change, and they no longer desire these things quite so much. So many people find it easier to just say, this food isn't helping me, let me just forget about it, and then to allow their tastes to drift in a different direction. Whereas if a person decides to that moderation is a good idea, they typically find they're in a constant struggle that never ends.
So if you are wanting to lose weight, if your blood pressure is up, if you find you're eating cheese all the time, it's really good to pay attention and give it a break, especially understanding what you've been sharing with us. And you know, it may not be our best option. I know that for people who want to cut down on red meat, cheese is often seen as a way to get some protein. Can we talk about the protein component? In cheese,
sure.
Is that a good thing? Is it beneficial? Is it something else that we need to know about that really is not serving us as well?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked about that, because it's the kind of the number one question people think about when they imagine they're not going to have meat or they're not going to have cheese or something. But it's an interesting thing. We do what I call elimination diets here sometimes. By here, I mean at the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. We're here in Washington, D.C. on Wisconsin Avenue, and sick people come in here, and we try to figure out what they're reacting to in some of the studies that we've done. And so we pull things out of the diet, and meat is gone, cheese is gone, some other things are gone, and we're trying to find out what food might be triggering their migraines or their arthritis. And what we discover is protein is never a problem. In other words, even if I throw out all the meat and all the dairy products and you're eating rice or beans or vegetables, the protein always adds up to be more than enough for the body's needs. It's just packed into the beans or vegetables or grains that they would be eating otherwise. So they don't need the protein from dairy. And that's also true if you are quite athletic. You just never need the dairy or meat protein. Because there's an abundance of it in other foods, even without special planning, really. However, the type of protein that is in dairy is a particular issue. In the Cheese Trap, I write about a person named Chad, who is a real person, and he was an athletic young guy as a kid. And he loved basketball and football and baseball, but he couldn't get through a game because he had asthma. and he had to go in and out of the emergency room, and so many kids have asthma. Well, when he was counseled to get all the animal products out of his diet, within a matter of weeks, his asthma was completely gone, as were his other allergies. And this, I use the asthma example. This is a condition where your body is reacting to proteins, in this case, dairy protein, creating antibodies that are attacking your body tissues. So it's not just asthma. Rheumatoid arthritis or sometimes skin conditions or other things can come from the same thing, and the trigger is the protein. And let's say a well-meaning family has a new baby, and for whatever reason, the mother is not breastfeeding, and instead of breast milk, the baby gets milk from a cow that's modified to be baby formula, but the proteins are cow's proteins. We learned a long time ago that choice increases the child's risk of a different autoimmune condition, that's type 1 diabetes. So, yeah, there's protein in cow's milk. That protein was designed for a calf, not for you, and I would encourage people to not have it.
You know, I'm sure people listening are saying, but cheese has been cultivated for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years around the world in many cultures. Well, what's different about what's happening now? And was it always a bad idea, or is something happening now that makes it less than a nutritious health food?
I think it was always a problem, but it's a worse problem now because if you're having a cigarette once a month, who cares? But if you're doing it every day, you're at risk. Back in 1909, Americans didn't eat cheese. It was Swiss people ate cheese. You know, as I mentioned earlier, the average American ate less than 4 pounds of it in a year. The rise of cheese in the particularly since the 1980s and 90s parallels exactly the rise in obesity. And although soda has gone down since 1999, we're consuming less soda, less sugar. Cheese is going up, and so is obesity. The other thing is, you see this amazing experiment happening in other parts of the world. Dairying began in Europe and perhaps parts of the Middle East. And if there's one thing you want to say for it, if you're starving and you happen to have an animal that you can milk, and then if you turn it into cheese, you can transport that food for a while, so it'll fend off starvation. But if you had a choice, it would not be a very helpful thing to eat. Look what's been happening in Japan. Japan is a culture that never consumed dairy products and milk, and you know, and most days of the week it was not part of their culture. That's true throughout many of those Asian countries. Starting a generation ago, to be big and strong like Americans, they started to eat like Americans and were pushed to consume milk. And the rise in diet-related diseases has been alarming. We're seeing cardiovascular disease, certain cancers, menarche in girls, I'm talking about the age of puberty, basically, has been dropping as it has here. You know, girls mature sexually way before they're ready to have a baby. I mean, you physically can get pregnant, but you are not psychologically mature enough to raise a child when you're 12. Nature did not intend that. Our diet changes is the most likely reason for why that has been occurring. And it's occurring now, that change is happening now in Asia, but it happened in European countries and in America much before that, because the diet changes we made dietary wrong turns much sooner.
Yeah, and I think we do need to see that connection between allergies and phlegm and mucus and earaches and so many of those conditions that have to do with consumption of too much dairy and cheese.
And you know who's really spearheading this is the athletic world. It's where lately people who watch the Super Bowl know that Tom Brady, who won he's the winningest quarterback we've ever had, will say, I don't eat that stuff at all. And why not? And Aaron Rodgers, who's the quarterback for the Green Bay Packers, same story. He said, I won't have any milk. I don't eat cheese at all. Which for him was something, because he's in the dairy state. He's playing for the cheeseheads, for the Green Bay Packers. But he says, look, I want to extend my career. And what he's talking about is inflammation. So for what maybe somebody else is, a little bit of sniffles or an earache in a baby or asthma or something like that, for them, means after an athletic workout, they don't recover very quickly if they're having dairy. So they leave it out for that reason. And the football people, I think they're the most recent people to join in. Before that, it was tennis. So Venus Williams and Serena Williams and Novak Djokovic in male tennis, they stopped consuming dairy a long time. And frankly, they don't eat animal products at all, that group. And then before that, it was the distance runners like Scott Jurek. I'm talking about the people at the absolute peak level of performance. They very often go to completely vegan diets because their performance is better, their blood is less viscous, it's less thick, and their recovery is faster because they don't have these allergenic proteins. So my feeling is if your goal is to just walk across the room and perform in life, you can eat like a top-level athlete, too, if you want to.
Right. Okay, so let's talk about options because there are these alternative cheeses, which I actually kind of have some questions about, you know, the soy cheese and almond cheeses and all these alternative versions, which I guess my concern is that they're so processed to make them into something that replicates cheese. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I think they're unnecessary. They're consumed for entertainment purposes, just like cheese. You know, you think, I'd like to have a taste, I'll have it. However, there is no food more processed than cheese itself. People will say, well, you must mean Velveeta. No, I mean cheddar. To write this book, I went to Cheddar, which is a town 2 hours west of London. And I went to Camembert as well in France, and I looked at how this is made. And there is no food more ridiculously processed than cheese. And the process, of course, is you take grass, which has calcium and protein in it, and you feed it into a bovine. The cow eats it. The cow has four stomachs and is busily fermenting the foods that the cow ultimately then absorbs the nutrients. Nutrients go through the cow's body, are combined with cholesterol and estrogens and so forth. It ends up in the cow's udder, and then the farmer expresses it out into a pail, delivers it to a factory where bacteria are added to ferment it. You add rennet, which is an enzyme from the fourth stomach of a slaughtered calf, or almost every cheese factory now uses genetically engineered rennet.
Oh, no. That's enough to turn us off right there.
Well, they all do. The cheese factories, they don't want to come in. They don't want to dissect the fourth stomach of a calf. They're all using genetically engineered rennet, all of them. And so with very few exceptions, and frankly, if it's from a calf, it's no better. So that then coagulates it, and then they add a ton of salt, and they put it in a block, and they tell you this is something natural. It's completely unnatural. And if it's Velveeta or other processed cheeses, it's no worse than the cheddar. It's just the ends that are kind of whipped up in a way that makes it more meltable. But none of this has anything to do with a normal human food. We think of it as normal only because we grew up with it. And anything people grow up with, they think of as normal, even though nature can't quite figure out what we're doing.
Wow. So how did the people receive you in England and cheddar and in the Camembert country?
they're glad to show what they do. My hope is that over time that we'll see a transition in our culture, as we have in many cases, away from things that are not so hot. And I think some of this is driven by young people who are not looking at this through the lens of a physician or health. They are looking at what the animals go through, which is frightening too. You cannot get milk from a cow if you allow her calf to have it. And so every cow on every farm is impregnated every year, and when she gives birth and she's licking her newborn baby and the baby is blinking his eyes and looking up at mom, the farmer arrives with a wheelbarrow and fights the mom for that baby. And in other words, puts the baby into a wheelbarrow and carts the baby off. The mother will follow until a gate is slammed in her face, and she will cry all night long for her baby. And the farmer says, look, I can't run a dairy if you have your baby. The male calves are slaughtered for veal fairly soon. The females grow up. Once they're old enough to be artificially inseminated themselves, they go through the same separation cycle every single year. And at about age 4, the farmer does the math and realizes that mom is not worth her feed anymore, and she will be trucked off to the same slaughterhouse that the beef cows go to. And so people who have a heart for animals, who visit one of these places and watch what happened. And especially if you can, stay at a hotel right next to the dairy and listen to the mothers crying out at night for their babies that have been taken away. You just think, what is a slice of cheese on my burger? Is this really what I want out of life? And for many young people who are not concerned about the health issues of it, because they're not aware of that yet, they think this is not a civilized product. And I have to say, I understand what they mean. Let me be clear. My prejudices are all in the opposite direction. I grew up in North Dakota. I come from a long line of cattle ranching people. They're good folks. They don't mean any of these nasty things that the industry has intrinsic to it. And it was quite some time myself as a Midwesterner who grew up in this kind of thing before I realized sort of that there's maybe a different way of looking at it.
Well, you know, there's one other question that I have. A lot of people, especially women, look at cheese and dairy products to help them with their bones. And this is a huge myth. I've written about this, and I'd like you to address that as well.
Yeah. First of all, you do need calcium for your bones, and you need a lot of other things, too. You need exercise. You need vitamin D, which comes from the sun. But the cow doesn't make calcium. The cow just ingests calcium from grass, green leafy vegetables, including grass and broccoli and everything. They have a lot of calcium in them. That's where it comes from. So human beings would normally be eating leaves of various kinds. We call them kale or broccoli or whatever, Brussels sprouts. Lots of calcium. It's very highly absorbed. But if you say, no, I'm not going to have that, I want the cow to eat the green leafy vegetable, and then I'm going to drink the cow's milk, that absorption fraction is actually much less. It's about 32% absorption from cow's milk. So you can get plenty of calcium. Just get it from the actual source, not from the cow. Eat your greens. Good to do that. It's good to get exercise and sunlight.
Yeah. You know, in my book, Hormone Heresy, I really looked at this whole issue of osteoporosis because when osteoporosis was created as a disease in women, menopausal women, estrogen deficiency, they all kind of came together in order to reintroduce hormones into the population in the early 90s and to push hormone replacement therapy. And then certain other industries kind of tagged along. And one of them was the dairy industry, saying that dairy provides the calcium that helps with bones. But all of this has proven to be false, and that there is very little true relationship between taking dairy and improving your bone density. If anything, it can impair it. So it's just part of this awakening to what's really going on, so we can find the truth and really be able to make the best choices that really do support us and not operate out of propaganda or misinformation.
It is a little bit disturbing to see the extent to which people are trying to sell dairy as a solution for this and another bone scan that you have to track your osteoporosis and so forth. I mean, there certainly is a role for good medical evaluations and so forth, but really the bottom line, when you look at individuals who do well and have strong bones, it's having a good, healthy diet, rich in vegetables and fruits and whole grains and beans. And I honestly don't know why a vegetable and fruit-rich diet is good for the bones. It may be just the calcium, but it's probably the magnesium and the right kind of protein that the body does well. Who knows? And then getting lots of good exercise. And frankly, we had the bad judgment to leave our wonderful home in tropical Africa to end up in places like Fargo and Newark and all the various places that humans migrated to over the millennia. Back when we were in our tropical origin, there was a lot of sunlight, so vitamin D was extremely plentiful, whereas where I grew up in near the Canadian border, there was not so much of it, and you need sunlight for vitamin D.
Right. Yes, I don't know why people moved to North Dakota.
I kept asking my parents that. I said, you know, I know you're Midwesterners, but really, Florida is nice this time of year.
Well, you know, I encourage encourage people to pick up a copy of your book, The Cheese Trap, How Breaking a Surprising Addiction Will Help You Lose Weight, Gain Energy, and Get Healthy. Dr. Barnard, do you have a website that you'd like to direct people to, or should we just send them to your Facebook page?
No, we do have a website. And let me, if you don't mind, give a shout-out to Drina Burton, who did the recipes for this, because it's not all gloom and doom. There are terrific ways to replace the cheese in your ravioli, in your lasagna, and even your cheesecake. I have one for you, without a drop of dairy. And that's it. I have to say that I've written a lot of books, but The Cheese Trap is the funnest, goofiest one I ever wrote. So I hope people find it fun, and I hope they like the recipes. But there is a website called thecheesetrap.org, and you'll get a taste for it there.
You know, I have to say, I've been looking through the section of your book that has the recipes, and aside from, you know, mushroom burgers and all sorts of natural burgers, but then you've got vanilla bean chocolate cake and chocolate peanut butter gelato, and you've got chocolate almond macaroons, and I mean, divine cheesecake. So I think there is life after cheese, and we really need to be open to that, especially if we are really committed to optimal health and rejuvenation, which is so important for us to really understand and commit to if we want to stay healthy and vital. You know, I have this 94-year-old mother, and I go and visit her in her community with all these other 90-year-olds who are pretty amazing. But you know what? They're all suffering with their aches and pains and their high cholesterol and their carotid arteries being blocked. And I'm thinking, oh, gosh, if only you guys knew how to really look after your health. Even at that point in their life, if they were to make changes, which they don't, but certainly the earlier you start, the more you're going to benefit, so you can be healthy now and have truly healthy aging as you go through your life. So it's important to listen to what we're talking about today.
Well, if you don't mind, let me just throw in one other thing. That the Chicago Health and Aging Study, the Chicago Health and Aging Project, I'm sorry, began in 1993 to try to see if they could track down the causes of Alzheimer's. The first thing that really hit the headlines was saturated fat. It's bad for the heart. It's also a huge contributor to Alzheimer's. The people who eat the most of it have about three times the risk of Alzheimer's compared to the people who eat the least. Well, what is the leading source of saturated fat in the American diet? It's cheese and other dairy products. Mm. Meat comes in second. So we think, oh, isn't this cute? My child loves grilled cheese, and I really love it, and I'm hooked on it. Don't take my cheese away. Wait a minute. You don't want people to take your memories away and your health away and your slimness away. And it's true that we can kind of joke about other things that are good taste, and frankly, I can make you a great ravioli, and the cheese job is filled with nice things. But the thing that tastes the best is to be in a body that rewards you and makes you feel good and doesn't have aches and pains and allows you to do things and travel and remember who your grandkids are. And so that's what this is all about. Fuel your body for high performance, and your tastes start to embrace that too, and you won't want that glob of yellow asphalt after a little while.
Absolutely. And, you know, but in the last couple of minutes, I thought it might be helpful for people to know a little bit more about the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, because I know you're the president and founder, and I'd like people to know more about it.
It was 1985. I finished my residency at George Washington University here in Washington, D.C., and I moved to New York, and I was working at a big hospital there called St. Vincent's. And at St. Vincent's Hospital, I had a very busy practice. And while I was there, I became concerned that we weren't really doing anything about a heart attack until it came into the emergency room door. In other words, prevention was not on our radar. And that was true for cancer. You know, we're not going to worry about your cancer until I find it on a mammogram or on a prostate exam. And I thought, we've got to do more about prevention, and that means food. And I was also concerned about how research was done. We were busily trying to find the answers to Alzheimer's disease by damaging the brains of mice and rats. And I thought, wait. There are human beings here that we need to understand. So we've been pushing on these issues for now 32 years and have made huge progress. There's much more awareness than there was before. We have about 14,000 doctors in the Physicians Committee and maybe 200,000 lay supporters. And the website is pcrm.org, and people can log on, see our materials, join us if they'd like. And if they're in the Washington, D.C. area, they should come by for a visit. We've got a big staff here and would love to visit them. We've also started a huge research center where we bring people in and work with them in research studies, as well as a medical center for people who need medical help.
So you actually have a medical center people can come who are seeking help to get healthy or deal with some health challenges?
It's called the Barnard Medical Center. And you can come in for a urinary tract infection or a twisted ankle or whatever, but the real focus is we make sure that every single person who comes through also has a chance to really look at their diet and get on a healthier path. So if a person has diabetes, we will look at their diet. We have three dietitians on staff who will work with them individually, and we have classes which are all free, and you can stay in the class as long as you want, and people's lives just transform. You would not believe. And people love to get off their medications when they can and to slim down and feel good. And the staff loves it because they've got the ability to really help people in a way that just a prescription alone is not going to do. But the patients love it because they're finally getting the cause of their problems addressed.
Absolutely, which is what medicine should be offering us, as you know only too well, and so often doesn't really address how to get healthy, how to restore health. So it's wonderful that you're doing such good work, and I certainly encourage people to go check out the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, the Barnard Center, and definitely read The Cheese Trap, How Breaking a Surprising Addiction Will Help You Lose Weight, Gain Energy, and Get Healthy. Dr. Barnard, I am so grateful for your time today. I'm grateful for your research. I'm grateful to know that you're teaching in a medical school, which to me is very encouraging that they, you know, are open to you. By the way, what do you teach in the medical school at George Washington?
Well, first of all, let me say, things are changing. It is true. A generation ago, nobody ever talked about any of this stuff. But just this past weekend, I was actually out in California working with doctors in the Permanente Medical Group. And there were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them, and they are eager for this information. So, no, things are changing. My lectures are all about nutrition. And so we focus on brain health, which we just touched on briefly earlier, weight loss. I'm more than anything else, I think I'm known as the diabetes guy who wants to make your diabetes go away instead of just catering to it if we can. And so all these things relate to what we're eating, and the prescription is 180 degrees different from my Fargo, North Dakota diet that I grew up on. And so my moral of the story is if I can change, you can change. As a medical student, I quit smoking. I ended up throwing out the meat. I kind of had to do a whole body reform, but I've done it, and other people can do it too, and you never want to look back because you feel so good. And frankly, the new foods you're eating are better than the old ones.
Well, again, thank you for the wonderful work you're doing, for the books you're writing, and helping to enlighten your colleagues in medical school, but all of us out there. So it's a pleasure having you with us today. Thanks again for being with us.
Well, thank you for including me.
And to all of you listening, thank you for joining me once again. And remember to always honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Bye for now.